Audio Scholar is pleased to present How the Mind Works by Steven Pinker. Executive producer is Lawrence Bauman. Steven Pinker is professor of psychology and director of the Center for Cognitive Neurosciences at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He is the author of Language Learnability and Language Development, Learnability and Cognition, and The Language Instinct. And now, How the Mind Works by Steven Pinker. Standard equipment. The complex structure of the mind is the subject of this book. Its key idea can be captured in a sentence. The mind is a system of organs of computation designed by natural selection to solve the kinds of problems our ancestors faced in their foraging way of life, in particular, understanding and outmaneuvering objects, animals, plants, and other people. The summary can be unpacked into several claims. The mind is what the brain does. Specifically, the brain processes information, and thinking is a kind of computation. The mind is organized into modules, or mental organs, each with a specialized design that makes it an expert in one arena of interaction with the world. The module's basic logic is specified by our genetic program. Their operation was shaped by natural selection to solve the problems of the hunting and gathering life led by our ancestors in most of our evolutionary history. The various problems for our ancestors were subtasks of one big problem for their genes, maximizing the number of copies that made it into the next generation. On this view, psychology is engineering in reverse. In forward engineering, one designs a machine to do something. In reverse engineering, one figures out what a machine was designed to do. Reverse engineering is what the boffins at Sony do when a new product is announced by Panasonic, or vice versa. They buy one, bring it back to the lab, take a screwdriver to it, and try to figure out what all the parts are for and how they combine to make the device work. We all engage in reverse engineering when we face an interesting new gadget. In rummaging through an antique store, we may find a contraption that is inscrutable until we figure out what it was designed to do. When we realize that it is an olive pitter, we suddenly understand that the metal ring is designed to hold the olive, and the lever lowers an X-shaped blade through one end, pushing the pit out through the other end. The shapes and arrangements of the springs, hinges, blades, levers, and rings all make sense in a satisfying rush of insight. We even understand why canned olives have an X-shaped incision at one end. In the 17th century, William Harvey discovered that veins had valves and deduced that the valves must be there to make the blood circulate. Since then, we have understood the body as a wonderful complex machine, an assembly of struts, ties, springs, pulleys, levers, joints, hinges, sockets, tanks, pipes, valves, sheaths, pumps, exchangers, and filters. Even today, we can be delighted to learn what mysterious parts are for. Why do we have our wrinkled asymmetrical ears? Because they filter sound waves coming from different directions in different ways. The nuances of the sound shadow tell the brain whether the source of the sound is above or below, in front of or behind us. The strategy of reverse engineering the body has continued in the last half of this century as we have explored the nanotechnology of the cell and of the molecules of life. The stuff of life turned out to be not a quivering, glowing, wondrous gel, but a contraption of tiny jigs, springs, hinges, rods, sheets, magnets, zippers, and trap doors, assembled by a data tape whose information is copied, downloaded, and scanned. The rationale for reverse engineering living things comes, of course, from Charles Darwin. He showed how organs of extreme perfection and complication, which justly excite our admiration, arise not from God's foresight, but from the evolution of replicators over immense spans of time. As replicators replicate, random copying errors sometimes crop up, and those that happen to enhance the survival and reproduction rate of the replicator tend to accumulate over the generations. Plants and animals are replicators, and their complicated machinery thus appears to have been engineered to allow them to survive and reproduce. Darwin insisted that his theory explained not just the complexity of an animal's body, but the complexity of its mind. Psychology will be based on a new foundation, he famously predicted at the end of The Origin of Species. But Darwin's prophecy has not yet been fulfilled. More than a century after he wrote those words, the study of the mind is still mostly Darwin-free, often defiantly so. Evolution is said to be irrelevant, sinful, or fit only for speculation over a beer at the end of the day. The allergy to evolution in the social and cognitive sciences has been, I think, a barrier to understanding. The mind is an exquisitely organized system that accomplishes remarkable feats no engineer can duplicate. How could the forces that shape that system, and the purposes for which it was designed, be irrelevant to understanding it? Evolutionary thinking is indispensable, not in the form that many people think of, dreaming up missing links or narrating stories about the stages of man, but in the form of careful reverse engineering. Without reverse engineering, we are like the singer in Tom Paxton's The Marvelous Toy, reminiscing about a childhood present. It went zip when it moved, and pop when it stopped, and whir when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. Only in the past few years has Darwin's challenge been taken up by a new approach christened evolutionary psychology by the anthropologist John Tooby and the psychologist Leda Cosmides. Evolutionary psychology brings together two scientific revolutions. One is the cognitive revolution of the 1950s and 1960s, which explains the mechanics of thought and emotion in terms of information and computation. The other is the revolution in evolutionary biology of the 1960s and 1970s, which explains the complex adaptive design of living things in terms of selection among replicators. The two ideas make a powerful combination. Cognitive science helps us to understand how a mind is possible and what kind of mind we have. Evolutionary biology helps us to understand why we have the kind of mind we have. The evolutionary psychology of this book is, in one sense, a straightforward extension of biology, focusing on one organ, the mind, of one species, Homo sapiens. But in another sense, it is a radical thesis that discards the way issues about the mind have been framed for almost a century. The premises of this book are probably not what you think they are. Thinking is computation, I claim, but that does not mean that the computer is a good metaphor for the mind. The mind is a set of modules, but the modules are not encapsulated boxes or circumscribed swatches on the surface of the brain. The organization of our mental modules comes from our genetic program, but that does not mean that there is a gene for every trait or that learning is less important than we used to think. The mind is an adaptation designed by natural selection, but that does not mean that everything we think, feel, and do is biologically adaptive. We evolved from apes, but that does not mean we have the same minds as apes. And the ultimate goal of natural selection is to propagate genes, but that does not mean that the ultimate goal of people is to propagate genes. Let me show you why not. This book is about the brain, but I will not say much about neurons, hormones, and neurotransmitters. That is because the mind is not the brain, but what the brain does, and not even everything it does, such as metabolizing fat and giving off heat. The 1990s have been named the decade of the brain, but there will never be a decade of the pancreas. The brain's special status comes from a special thing the brain does, which makes us see, think, feel, choose, and act. That special thing is information processing, or computation. Information and computation reside in patterns of data and in relations of logic that are independent of the physical medium that carries them. When you telephone your mother in another city, the message stays the same as it goes from your lips to her ears, even as it physically changes its form, from vibrating air to electricity in a wire, to charges in silicon, to flickering light in a fiber optic cable, to electromagnetic waves, and then back again in reverse order. In a similar sense, the message stays the same when she repeats it to your father at the other end of the couch after it has changed its form inside her head into a cascade of neurons firing and chemicals diffusing across synapses. Likewise, a given program can run on computers made of vacuum tubes, electromagnetic switches, transistors, integrated circuits, or well-trained pigeons. And it accomplishes the same things for the same reasons. This insight, first expressed by the mathematician Alan Turing, the computer scientists Alan Newell, Herbert Simon, and Marvin Minsky, and the philosophers Hilary Putnam and Jerry Fodor, is now called the computational theory of mind. It is one of the great ideas in intellectual history, for it solves one of the puzzles that make up the mind-body problem: how to connect the ethereal world of meaning and intention, the stuff of our mental lives, with a physical hunk of matter like the brain. Why did Bill get on the bus? Because he wanted to visit his grandmother and knew the bus would take him there. No other answer will do. If he hated the sight of his grandmother, or if he knew the route had changed, his body would not be on that bus. For millennia, this has been a paradox. Entities like wanting to visit one's grandmother and knowing the bus goes to grandma's house are colorless, odorless, and tasteless. But at the same time, they are causes of physical events, as potent as any billiard ball clacking into another. The computational theory of mind resolves the paradox. It says that beliefs and desires are information, incarnated as configurations of symbols. The symbols are the physical states of bits of matter, like chips in a computer or neurons in the brain. They symbolize things in the world because they are triggered by those things via our sense organs, and because of what they do once they are triggered. If the bits of matter that constitute a symbol are arranged to bump into the bits of matter constituting another symbol in just the right way, the symbols corresponding to one belief can give rise to new symbols corresponding to another belief logically related to it, which can give rise to symbols corresponding to other beliefs, and so on. Eventually, the bits of matter constituting a symbol bump into bits of matter connected to the muscles, and behavior happens. The computational theory of mind thus allows us to keep beliefs and desires in our explanations of behavior while planting them squarely in the physical universe. It allows meaning to cause and be caused. The computational theory of mind is indispensable in addressing the questions we long to answer. Neuroscientists like to point out that all parts of the cerebral cortex look pretty much alike, not only the different parts of the human brain, but the brains of different animals. One could draw the conclusion that all mental activity in all animals is the same. But a better conclusion is that we cannot simply look at a patch of brain and read out the logic in the intricate pattern of connectivity that makes each part do its separate thing. In the same way that all books are physically just different combinations of the same 75 or so characters, and all movies are physically just different patterns of charges along the tracks of a videotape, the mammoth tangle of spaghetti of the brain may all look alike when examined strand by strand. The content of a book or a movie lies in the pattern of ink marks or magnetic charges, and is apparent only when the piece is read or seen. Similarly, the content of brain activity lies in the patterns of connections and patterns of activity among the neurons. Minute differences in the details of the connections may cause similar-looking brain patches to implement very different programs. Only when the program is run does the coherence become evident. As Tooby and Cosmides have written, "There are birds that migrate by the stars, bats that echolocate, bees that compute the variance of flower patches, spiders that spin webs, humans that speak, ants that farm, lions that hunt in teams, cheetahs that hunt alone, monogamous gibbons, polyandrous seahorses, polygynous gorillas. There are millions of animal species on Earth, each with a different set of cognitive programs. The same basic neural tissue embodies all of these programs, and it could support many others as well. Facts about the properties of neurons, neurotransmitters, and cellular development cannot tell you which of these millions of programs the human mind contains. Even if all neural activity is the expression of a uniform process at the cellular level, it is the arrangement of neurons into birdsong templates or web-spinning programs that matters." That does not imply, of course, that the brain is irrelevant to understanding the mind. Programs are assemblies of simple information processing units, tiny circuits that can add, match a pattern, turn on some other circuit, or do other elementary logical and mathematical operations. What those microcircuits can do depends only on what they are made of. Circuits made from neurons cannot do exactly the same things as circuits made from silicon, and vice versa. For example, a silicon circuit is faster than a neural circuit, but a neural circuit can match a larger pattern than a silicon one. These differences ripple up through the programs built from the circuits and affect how quickly and easily the programs do various things, even if they do not determine exactly which things they do. My point is not that prodding brain tissue is irrelevant to understanding the mind, only that it is not enough. Psychology, the analysis of mental software, will have to burrow a considerable way into the mountain before meeting the neurobiologists tunneling through from the other side. The computational theory of mind is not the same thing as the despised computer metaphor. As many critics have pointed out, computers are serial, doing one thing at a time. Brains are parallel, doing millions of things at once. Computers are fast, brains are slow. Computer parts are reliable, brain parts are noisy. Computers have a limited number of connections, brains have trillions. Computers are assembled according to a blueprint. Brains must assemble themselves. Yes, and computers come in putty-colored boxes and have auto-exec bat files and run screensavers with flying toasters, and brains do not. The claim is not that the brain is like commercially available computers. Rather, the claim is that brains and computers embody intelligence for some of the same reasons. To explain how birds fly, we invoke principles of lift and drag and fluid mechanics that also explain how airplanes fly. That does not commit us to an airplane metaphor for birds, complete with jet engines and complimentary beverage service. Without the computational theory, it is impossible to make sense of the evolution of the mind. Most intellectuals think that the human mind must somehow have escaped the evolutionary process. Evolution, they think, can fabricate only stupid instincts and fixed action patterns. A sex drive, an aggression urge, a territorial imperative, hens sitting on eggs and ducklings following hulks. Human behavior is too subtle and flexible to be a product of evolution, they think. It must come from somewhere else. From, say, culture. But if evolution equipped us not with irresistible urges and rigid reflexes, but with a neural computer, everything changes. A program is an intricate recipe of logical and statistical operations directed by comparisons, tests, branches, loops, and subroutines embedded in subroutines. Artificial computer programs, from the Macintosh user interface to simulations of the weather to programs that recognize speech and answer questions in English, give us a hint of the finesse and power of which computation is capable. Human thought and behavior, no matter how subtle and flexible, could be the product of a very complicated program, and that program may have been our endowment from natural selection. The typical imperative from biology is not, "thou shalt," but, "if, then, else." The mind, I claim, is not a single organ, but a system of organs, which we can think of as psychological faculties or mental modules. The entities now commonly evoked to explain the mind, such as general intelligence, a capacity to form culture, and multi-purpose learning strategies, will surely go the way of protoplasm in biology and of earth, air, fire, and water in physics. These entities are so formless compared to the exacting phenomena they are meant to explain that they must be granted near magical powers. When the phenomena are put under the microscope, we discover that the complex texture of the everyday world is supported not by a single substance, but by many layers of elaborate machinery. Biologists long ago replaced the concept of an all-powerful protoplasm with the concept of functionally specialized mechanisms. The organ systems of the body do their jobs because each is built with a particular structure tailored to the task. The heart circulates the blood because it is built like a pump. The lungs oxygenate the blood because they are built like gas exchangers. The lungs cannot pump blood and the heart cannot oxygenate it. This specialization goes all the way down. Heart tissue differs from lung tissue, heart cells differ from lung cells, and many of the molecules making up heart cells differ from those making up lung cells. If that were not true, our organs would not work. A jack of all trades is master of none, and that is just as true for our mental organs as for our physical organs. The robot challenge makes that clear. Building a robot poses many software engineering problems, and different tricks are necessary to solve them. Take our first problem, the sense of sight. A seeing machine must solve a problem called inverse optics. Ordinary optics is the branch of physics that allows one to predict how an object with a certain shape, material, and illumination projects the mosaic of colors we call the retinal image. Optics is a well-understood subject, put to use in drawing, photography, television engineering, and more recently, computer graphics and virtual reality. But the brain must solve the opposite problem. The input is the retinal image, and the output is a specification of the objects in the world and what they are made of. That is, what we know we are seeing. And there's the rub. Inverse optics is what engineers call an ill-posed problem. It literally has no solution. Just as it is easy to multiply some numbers and announce the product, but impossible to take a product and announce the numbers that were multiplied to get it, optics is easy, but inverse optics impossible. Yet your brain does it every time you open the refrigerator and pull out a jar. How can this be? The answer is that the brain supplies the missing information, information about the world we evolved in and how it reflects light. If the visual brain assumes that it is living in a certain kind of world, an evenly lit world made mostly of rigid parts with smooth, uniformly colored surfaces, it can make good guesses about what is out there. It's impossible to distinguish coal from snow by examining the brightnesses of their retinal projections. But say there is a module for perceiving the properties of surfaces, and built into it is the following assumption. The world is smoothly and uniformly lit. The module can solve the coal versus snow problem in three steps. Subtract out any gradient of brightness from one edge of the scene to the other. Estimate the average level of brightness of the whole scene, and calculate the shade of gray of each patch by subtracting its brightness from the average brightness. Large positive deviations from the average are then seen as white things, large negative deviations as black things. If the illumination really is smooth and uniform, those perceptions will register the surfaces of the world accurately. Since planet Earth has, more or less, met the even illumination assumption for eons, natural selection would have done well by building the assumption in. The surface perception module solves an unsolvable problem, but at a price. The brain has given up any pretense of being a general problem solver. It has been equipped with a gadget that perceives the nature of surfaces in typical earthly viewing conditions because it is specialized for that parochial problem. Change the problem slightly and the brain no longer solves it. Say we place a person in a world that is not blanketed with sunshine, but illuminated by a cunningly arranged patchwork of light. If the surface perception module assumes that illumination is even, it should be seduced into hallucinating objects that aren't there. Could that really happen? It happens every day. We call these hallucinations slideshows and movies and television, complete with the illusory black I mentioned earlier. When we watch TV, we stare at a shimmering piece of glass, but our surface perception module tells the rest of our brain that we are seeing real people and places. The module has been unmasked. It does not apprehend the nature of things, but relies on a cheat sheet. That cheat sheet is so deeply embedded in the operation of our visual brain that we cannot erase the assumptions written on it. Even in a lifelong couch potato, the visual system never learns that television is a pane of glowing phosphor dots, and the person never loses the illusion that there is a world behind the pane. Our other mental modules need their own cheat sheets to solve their unsolvable problems. A physicist who wants to figure out how the body moves when muscles are contracted has to solve problems in kinematics, the geometry of motion, and dynamics, the effects of forces. But a brain that has to figure out how to contract muscles to get the body to move has to solve problems in inverse kinematics and inverse dynamics. What forces to apply to an object to get it to move in a certain trajectory? Like inverse optics, inverse kinematics and dynamics are ill-posed problems. Our motor modules solve them by making extraneous but reasonable assumptions. Not assumptions about illumination, of course, but assumptions about bodies in motion. Our common sense about other people is a kind of intuitive psychology. We try to infer other people's beliefs and desires from what they do, and try to predict what they will do from our guesses about their beliefs and desires. Our intuitive psychology, though, must make the assumption that other people have beliefs and desires. We cannot sense a belief or desire in another person's head the way we smell oranges. If we did not see the social world through the lens of that assumption, we would be like the Samaritan One robot, which sacrificed itself for a bag of lima beans, or like Samaritan Two, which went overboard for any object with a human-like head, even if the head belonged to a large wind-up toy. Later we shall see that people suffering from a certain syndrome lack the assumption that people have minds and do treat other people as wind-up toys. Even our feelings of love for our family members embody a specific assumption about the laws of the natural world, in this case an inverse of the ordinary laws of genetics. Family feelings are designed to help our genes replicate themselves, but we cannot see or smell genes. Scientists use forward genetics to deduce how genes get distributed among organisms. For example, meiosis and sex cause the offspring of two people to have 50% of their genes in common. Our emotions about kin use a kind of inverse genetics to guess which of the organisms we interact with are likely to share our genes. For example, if someone appears to have the same parents as you do, treat the person as if their genetic well-being overlaps with yours. I will return to all these topics in later chapters. The mind has to be built out of specialized parts because it has to solve specialized problems. Only an angel could be a general problem solver. We mortals have to make fallible guesses from fragmentary information. Each of our mental modules solves its unsolvable problems by a leap of faith about how the world works, by making assumptions that are indispensable but indefensible, the only defense being that the assumptions worked well enough in the world of our ancestors. The word module brings to mind detachable snap-in components, and that is misleading. Mental modules are not likely to be visible to the naked eye as circumscribed territories on the surface of the brain, like the flank steak and the rump roast on the supermarket cow display. A mental module probably looks more like roadkill, sprawling messily over the bulges and crevices of the brain. Or it may be broken into regions that are interconnected by fibers that make the regions act as a unit. The beauty of information processing is the flexibility of its demand for real estate. Just as a corporation's management can be scattered across sites linked by a telecommunications network, or a computer program can be fragmented into different parts of the disk or memory, the circuitry underlying a psychological module might be distributed across the brain in a spatially haphazard manner. And mental modules need not be tightly sealed off from one another, communicating only through a few narrow pipelines. That is a specialized sense of module that many cognitive scientists have debated, following a definition by Jerry Fodor. Modules are defined by the special things they do with the information available to them, not necessarily by the kinds of information they have available. So the metaphor of the mental module is a bit clumsy. A better one is Noam Chomsky's mental organ. An organ of the body is a specialized structure tailored to carry out a particular function. But our organs do not come in a bag like chicken giblets. They are integrated into a complex whole. The body is composed of systems divided into organs assembled from tissues built out of cells. Some kinds of tissues, like the epithelium, are used with modifications in many organs. Some organs, like the blood and the skin, interact with the rest of the body across a widespread, convoluted interface and cannot be encircled by a dotted line. Sometimes it is unclear where one organ leaves off and another begins, or how big a chunk of the body we want to call an organ. Is the hand an organ? The finger? A bone in the finger? These are all pedantic questions of terminology, and anatomists and physiologists have not wasted their time on them. What is clear is that the body is not made of spam, but has a heterogeneous structure of many specialized parts. All this is likely to be true of the mind. Whether or not we establish exact boundaries for the components of the mind, it is clear that it is not made of mental spam, but has a heterogeneous structure of many specialized parts. Our physical organs owe their complex design to the information in the human genome, and so, I believe, do our mental organs. We do not learn to have a pancreas, and we do not learn to have a visual system, language acquisition, common sense, or feelings of love, friendship, and fairness. No single discovery proves the claim, just as no single discovery proves that the pancreas is innately structured. But many lines of evidence converge on it. The one that most impresses me is the robot challenge. Each of the major engineering problems solved by the mind is unsolvable without built-in assumptions about the laws that hold in that arena of interaction with the world. All of the programs designed by artificial intelligence researchers have been specially engineered for a particular domain, such as language, vision, movement, or one of many different kinds of common sense. Within artificial intelligence research, the proud parent of a program will sometimes tout it as a mere demo of an amazingly powerful general-purpose system to be built in the future. But everyone else in the field routinely writes off such hype. I predict that no one will ever build a human-like robot, and I mean a really human-like robot, unless they pack it with computational systems tailored to different problems. Throughout the book, we will run into other lines of evidence that our mental organs owe their basic design to our genetic program. I have already mentioned that much of the fine structure of our personality and intelligence is shared by identical twins, reared apart and hence charted by the genes. Infants and young children, when tested with ingenious methods, show a precocious grasp of the fundamental categories of the physical and social world, and sometimes command information that was never presented to them. People hold many beliefs that are at odds with their experience, but were true in the environment in which we evolved, and they pursue goals that subvert their own well-being but were adaptive in that environment. And contrary to the widespread belief that cultures can vary arbitrarily and without limit, surveys of the ethnographic literature show that the peoples of the world share an astonishingly detailed universal psychology. But if the mind has a complex innate structure, that does not mean that learning is unimportant. Framing the issue in such a way that innate structure and learning are pitted against each other, either as alternatives or, almost as bad, as complementary ingredients or interacting forces, is a colossal mistake. It's not that the claim that there is an interaction between innate structure and learning, or between heredity and environment, nature and nurture, biology and culture, is literally wrong. Rather, it falls into the category of ideas that are so bad they are not even wrong. Imagine the following dialogue. This new computer is brimming with sophisticated technology. It has a 500 megahertz processor, a gigabyte of RAM, a terabyte of disk storage, a 3D color virtual reality display, speech output, wireless access to the World Wide Web, expertise in a dozen subjects, and built-in editions of the Bible, the Encyclopedia Britannica, Bartlett's famous quotations, and the complete works of Shakespeare. Tens of thousands of hacker hours went into its design. Oh, so I guess you're saying that it doesn't matter what I type into the computer. With all that built-in structure, its environment can't be very important. It will always do the same thing, regardless of what I type in. The response is patently senseless. Having a lot of built-in machinery should make a system respond more intelligently and flexibly to its inputs, not less. Yet the reply captures how centuries of commentators have reacted to the idea of a richly structured high-tech mind. And the interactionist position, with its phobia of ever specifying the innate part of the interaction, is not much better. Look at these claims. The behavior of a computer comes from a complex interaction between the processor and the input. When trying to understand how a car works, one cannot neglect the engine or the gasoline or the driver. All are important factors. The sound coming out of this CD player represents the inextricably intertwined mixture of two crucial variables, the structure of the machine and the disc you insert into it. Neither can be ignored. These statements are true, but useless, so blankly uncomprehending, so defiantly incurious that it is almost as bad to assert them as to deny them. For minds, just as for machines, the metaphors of a mixture of two ingredients, like a martini, or a battle between matched forces, like a tug of war, are wrong-headed ways of thinking about a complex device designed to process information. Yes, every part of human intelligence involves culture and learning. But learning is not a surrounding gas or force field, and it does not happen by magic. It is made possible by innate machinery designed to do the learning. The claim that there are several innate modules is a claim that there are several innate learning machines. each of which learns according to a particular logic. To understand learning, we need new ways of thinking to replace the pre-scientific metaphors, the mixtures and forces, the writing on slates and sculpting of blocks of marble. We need ideas that capture the ways a complex device can tune itself to unpredictable aspects of the world and take in the kinds of data it needs to function. The idea that heredity and environment interact is not always meaningless, but I think it confuses two issues: what all minds have in common and how minds can differ. The vapid statements above can be made intelligible by replacing how X works with what makes X work better than Y. The usefulness of a computer depends on both the power of its processor and the expertise of the user. The speed of a car depends on the engine, the fuel, and the skill of the driver. All are important factors. The quality of sound coming from a CD player depends on two crucial variables: the player's mechanical and electronic design and the quality of the original recording. Neither can be ignored. When we are interested in how much better one system functions than a similar one, it is reasonable to gloss over the causal chains inside each system and tally up the factors that make the whole thing fast or slow, hi-fi or lo-fi. And this ranking of people to determine who enters medical school or who gets the job is where the framing of nature versus nurture comes from. But this book is about how the mind works, not about why some people's minds might work a bit better in certain ways than other people's minds. The evidence suggests that humans everywhere on the planet see, talk, and think about objects and people in the same basic way. The difference between Einstein and a high school dropout is trivial compared to the difference between the high school dropout and the best robot in existence, or between the high school dropout and a chimpanzee. That is the mystery I want to address. Nothing could be farther from my subject matter than a comparison between the means of overlapping bell curves for some crude consumer index like IQ. And for this reason, the relative importance of innateness and learning is a phony issue. An emphasis on innate design should not, by the way, be confused with the search for a gene for this or that mental organ. Think of the genes and putative genes that have made the headlines: genes for muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's, alcoholism, schizophrenia, manic depressive disorder, obesity, violent outbursts, dyslexia, bedwetting, and some kinds of retardation. They are disorders, all of them. There have been no discoveries of a gene for civility, language, memory, motor control, intelligence, or other complete mental systems, and there probably won't ever be. The reason was summed up by the politician Sam Rayburn: any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a carpenter to build one. Complex mental organs, like complex physical organs, surely are built by complex genetic recipes, with many genes cooperating in as yet unfathomable ways. A defect in any one of them could corrupt the whole device, just as a defect in any part of a complicated machine, like a loose distributor cable in a car, can bring the machine to a halt. The genetic assembly instructions for a mental organ do not specify every connection in the brain as if they were a wiring schematic for a Heathkit radio. And we should not expect each organ to grow under a particular bone of the skull, regardless of what else happens in the brain. The brain and all the other organs differentiate in embryonic development from a ball of identical cells. Every part of the body, from the toenails to the cerebral cortex, takes on its particular shape and substance when its cells respond to some kind of information in its neighborhood that unlocks a different part of the genetic program. The information may come from the taste of the chemical soup that a cell finds itself in, from the shapes of the molecular locks and keys that the cell engages, from mechanical tugs and shoves from neighboring cells, and other cues still poorly understood. The families of neurons that will form the different mental organs, all descendants of a homogeneous stretch of embryonic tissue, must be designed to be opportunistic as the brain assembles itself, seizing any available information to differentiate from one another. The coordinates in the skull may be one trigger for differentiation, but the pattern of input firings from connected neurons is another. Since the brain is destined to be an organ of computation, it would be surprising if the genome did not exploit the capacity of neural tissue to process information during brain assembly. In the sensory areas of the brain, where we can best keep track of what is going on, We know that early in fetal development, neurons are wired according to a rough genetic recipe. The neurons are born in appropriate numbers at the right times, migrate to their resting places, send out connections to their targets, and hook up to appropriate cell types in the right general regions, all under the guidance of chemical trails and molecular locks and keys. To make precise connections, though, the baby neurons must begin to function, and their firing pattern carries information downstream about their pinpoint connections. This isn't experience, as it all can take place in the pitch-black womb, sometimes before the rods and cones are functioning, and many mammals can see almost perfectly as soon as they are born. It is more like a kind of genetic data compression or a set of internally generated test patterns. These patterns can trigger the cortex at the receiving end to differentiate, at least one step of the way, into the kind of cortex that is appropriate to processing the incoming information. For example, in animals that have been cross-wired so that the eyes are connected to the auditory brain, that area shows a few hints of the properties of the visual brain. How the genes control brain development is still unknown, but a reasonable summary of what we know so far is that brain modules assume their identity by a combination of what kind of tissue they start out as, where they are in the brain, and what patterns of triggering input they get during critical periods in development. Our organs of computation are a product of natural selection. The biologist Richard Dawkins called natural selection the blind watchmaker. In the case of the mind, we can call it the blind programmer. Our mental programs work as well as they do because they were shaped by selection to allow our ancestors to master rocks, tools, plants, animals, and each other, ultimately in the service of survival and reproduction. Natural selection is not the only cause of evolutionary change. Organisms also change over the eons because of statistical accidents in who lives and who dies, environmental catastrophes that wipe out whole families of creatures, and the unavoidable byproducts of changes that are the product of selection. But natural selection is the only evolutionary force that acts like an engineer, designing organs that accomplish improbable but adaptive outcomes, a point that has been made forcefully by the biologist George Williams and by Dawkins. The textbook argument for natural selection, accepted even by those who feel that selection has been overrated, such as paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould, comes from the vertebrate eye. Just as a watch has too many finely meshing parts, gears, springs, pivots, and so on, to have been assembled by a tornado or a river eddy, entailing instead the design of a watchmaker, the eye has too many finely meshing parts, lens, iris, retina, and so on, to have arisen from a random evolutionary force like a big mutation, statistical drift, or the fortuitous shape of the nooks and crannies between other organs. The design of the eye must be a product of natural selection of replicators, the only non-miraculous natural process we know of that can manufacture well-functioning machines. The organism appears as if it was designed to see well now because it owes its existence to the success of its ancestors in seeing well in the past. This point will be expanded in Chapter 3. End of Side 1. Please turn to Side 2.